This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Next week, Connecticut residents will have the opportunity to vote in their municipal elections. But will they? Turnout is historically low, is part of the reason that information is scarce about who's running. Coming up, the CTNewsJunkies.com's Doug Hardy will join us to talk about a tool to help people learn more about local candidates. But first, Connecticut had the distinction of being the last state to pass a new budget. Thankfully, the General Assembly reached a bipartisan agreement late last week. Now, what's in the $41 billion deal? Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, joins us this hour to break down the plan. Part of the budget negotiations was whether the legislature could help Hartford avoid bankruptcy. This budget includes aid for the capital city. Mayor Bronin will join us later to talk about that. And we'll hear from Connecticut's Consumer Council about one gimmick lawmakers use to plug the deficit. More on that later. Now, do you have a question about the budget? What's your take on the plan lawmakers agreed to? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome Mark Pasniokas, again, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
You've been doing this a long time. How extraordinary was this last year, dealing with no budget for nearly 4 months?
It was unprecedented, really. This is the longest they've ever gone without a budget. I will admit to being a reporter here in 1991 when the state of Connecticut adopted its first broad-based taxes on wages. That fight lasted into late August. But there were some big differences between that year and this year. In 1991, you had this target, this solution, the income tax. And if you could round up the votes to do that, you were done. You had landed the great white whale and you could move on. This year, there was no great white whale out there. You had a bunch of little minnows and you had a bunch of gimmicks and, you know, and a bunch of hard decisions to make about cutting services. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why it took so darn long, well into the fall.
And we saw the makeup of the legislature different than in the past years. Tell us again how the structure of the Senate and the House contributed to this.
Absolutely.
Long wait.
That's another big difference. Connecticut, for the first time, really has a 50-50 legislature. It is exactly 50-50 in the state Senate, 18-18. The Democrats have a teeny edge in that the lieutenant governor, a Democrat, can break tie votes. And in the House, the advantage is 79-72. So if the Republicans could coax four Democrats to come over on any issue, they would have a 76-75 majority. So that definitely contributed to the degree of difficulty in getting a final budget deal. You know, we had other factors. You have a very strong-willed governor who is winding down. He is a lame duck. Everybody knows he's not coming back after the 2018 election. His popularity is in the 20s, you know, according to the last public poll we've seen. All that adds up to a situation in which really nobody has the clout to move this thing forward. And that's why it's one of the reasons why it dragged on and on and on.
This version that the House and Senate voted on late last week, who was in the room working on that deal?
Well, and that's very important because in the room through most of it was the six top leaders of the House and Senate, plus at different times some of their senior members who were involved in budget and some senior staff. But excluded was the Malloy administration and its Office of Policy and Management. And there are two ways of looking at that. One is they viewed the governor not as a constructive influence in these talks, that he was a bit of a buzzkill saying, no, you can't do that. The flip side of that is some of the time the Office of Policy Management is pointing out a problem with something early, and there's a reason for why they shouldn't do something. So that was the dynamic. Some of it was personality. Some of it was the legislative leaders decided we want to land this thing, we want to finish it, and we want to go home. So again, every budget, every tough budget, I should say, has a little bit of willful ignorance, mm-hmm. that you don't want to look too closely at something. And we will see the results of that, I think, in the coming days and weeks and potentially months. Most budgets in tough years, they don't age well. They don't look better the longer you look at it. You see things that are accounting gimmicks, budgeting gimmicks. You see potential shortfalls. And you see things that maybe are not the greatest public policy. You know, you see things that are non-fiscal items that are tucked into budgets. I wrote about one this morning, you know, where they changed the rules for how the State Elections Enforcement Commission can investigate legislators, among others. They have a tight deadline now of 1 year to get their work done because legislators were annoyed at how long some of these things took. And legislators, unlike the rest of us, when they get annoyed at how government interacts with them, they can change that.
Now, we've heard through the months of gridlock, you know, a lot of angst from towns because they were running out of money. So when we look at this budget deal, this $41 billion budget deal, Mark, how does that play out in terms of what kind of aid towns are getting, contributions and teacher pensions? That was something that Malloy had brought up in his budget proposal. So can you talk us through some
sure.
of the compromise?
So there was a lot going on there. Now, the governor wanted to make a structural change in how teacher pensions are funded. Connecticut is one of the few states that teacher pensions are funded by the state as well as by teacher contributions. So he started off by saying, we're going to have the towns contribute. The towns pushed back and said, wait a minute, this is a state function. You guys have kind of screwed it up by not funding it well. Don't push the liability onto us. That was a huge, huge issue. The governor also, when it became clear that they were not going to be able to pass a budget by the start of the fiscal year in July, he, through an executive order, increased pressure on the legislature and on the community, saying, look, I don't have the authority to continue sending state aid out through the education cost sharing program. That's the major state aid program. I think it's 3/4 of all state aid funnels through that program. The governor said, there's no budget. There's no functioning formula to distribute that. So that was a huge club. And that's what was driving cities and towns crazy, the prospect of losing that money. The governor was going to make payments to the most distressed communities because there is a constitutional obligation to provide free public education. And in about 30 communities without the state funding, there would be no free public education. So at the end of the day, in this budget, the cuts to education cost sharing were about 1.5%. And the 30 cities and towns with the greatest need, their funding was not cut. Funding to other communities, you know, more well-to-do communities. West Hartford, I think, was 5% over the 2 years cut. Fairfield, about 8%. But on average, I think it was about a 5% cut. And the rationale is these are communities that can afford to make up the difference. Not going to be easy, but that's where they ended up. So it was not a disaster for the cities and towns. At the end of the day, they were pretty happy.
So who are the losers in this budget?
The losers in the budget, teachers are not terribly happy. Their contributions for their pensions went from 6% to 7%. And there's a question as to whether these are really pension contributions or was it really a hidden tax. And the reason I say that is for every dollar that the teachers put in additionally, the state cuts back its contributions. So is this really a pension contribution or was this the state's way to cut its expenditures there? You know, the plus side as far as public policy goes, raising the teacher contributions puts it more in line with national averages, and employee contributions into pensions are stable. Unlike the General Assembly, employees, teachers cannot decide from year to year, we're not going to make our contribution. state of Connecticut over 30, 40 years quite often has decided they're not going to make its contribution or not make all of its contribution. And that's one of the major reasons why the state of Connecticut was in the dire fiscal straits it found itself in this year.
Now, what about UConn? Now, the Republican proposal really hit UConn hard with compromise. How much will they be losing?
In the Republican budget, which unexpectedly passed, and that's important to keep in mind, there's always a question when the minority party puts forward a budget. Is this meant to be a working budget to run the state on? Or is this meant to be a political statement saying, hey, these are the areas, you know, we think are overfunded, or this is how we're just going to get to a balanced budget and we don't have to worry because we don't have to live with it. Well, this time it passed. And one of the cuts in there was to UConn would have lost at least $240 million. The governor and others spoke out very strongly against this for a variety of reasons. One, Connecticut, when national groups look at Connecticut as a place to do business, there's a lot of things that Connecticut gets bad grades on. But aside from quality of life, the two things that Connecticut uniformly gets good grades on is the quality of its education and the quality of its workforce. And those two things are closely linked. So the governor was saying, this is insanity to gut higher education at this point. So instead of a $240 million cut, the governor, by the way, had put in, you know, 20, 30, I think he got as high as $40 million in a compromise he reached with Democrats that didn't pass. This gets it above $60 million, $65 million, somewhere in there. So it's going to be felt, but it's not going to be disastrous, certainly.
Mark Pasniokas is in the studio with us. He's a Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Today, we're learning more about that budget deal that was finally voted on late last week. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You made the point earlier, Mark, that members of Malloy's office and the governor, as well as OPM, were not in the room when that final deal was figured out before the vote. One of the consequences, let's talk about this error that we've heard that's in the budget, a $1 billion error related to the hospital.
Well, it depends on how many years you're looking at. But okay, so we're talking about the hospital provider tax, which is really hard for reporters to explain and for legislators to understand and certainly for the public to embrace. In many ways, it is a scam. It's a scam practice to one degree or another by 49 of the 50 states. And it's considered a scam in that it is a way to boost federal reimbursements in Medicaid. Medicaid is a program, a healthcare program for, you know, generally for poorer people. It's 50% funded by the feds, 50% by the state. So the rationale behind this is if you raise taxes on the provision of services by hospitals, you can then up the reimbursements to them, and then you can get federal matching funds. All right, everybody follow that? And this has been, again, called, you know, a real scam. It's really been going on for 9-10 years. And again, there are about 30 states that do it heavily and the rest to one degree or another. Now, the problem that came up, this is technical stuff. The Malloy administration said the legislature, the language to raise this hospital provider tax was flawed. The Hospital Association, which provided some of the language, says no, they're comfortable with it. Now, the hospitals certainly have a vested interest in making sure this works and the federal money comes in. Now, one of the administration's concerns is that the way it was written, it looked like the hospitals would get their additional money regardless of whether the feds reimbursed it. Now, as a practical matter, if that was the case, the General Assembly probably would come back and repeal that, because in the immediate budget this year, next year, the net increase in this little accounting game was about $137 million in each year. So if this blows up, there's a hole in the budget. So, but it's one of the many ways that there are consequences intended and unintended when you start doing these things.
You called that a scam. Coming up, we're going to be talking about...
Joe Biden called it a scam too, by the way.
We'll pin it on him. We'll be talking about another gimmick in the budget that actually raids energy funds. That'll be coming up a little bit later. The question before we head to break, Mark, is the governor going to sign this? He's got a deadline coming up.
He has a deadline of Wednesday. Okay, here are the brief arguments that are being made to the governor and that the governor has to consider. If he vetoes it, he knows he will not throw the state back into chaos because this passed by veto-proof margins, by huge margins. And if this thing turns out not to be balanced or if there are other defects that become apparent the longer we look at it, if the governor has vetoed it, he will be in a position to say, I told you so. Not that our governor would do that. But it gives him some distance. The downside is a huge political risk, which is going into your last full year as governor. He's not running in 2018. Do you want to really end this year and kind of go into the next year having the legislature, you know, kind of dope slap you with an override on the biggest issue of the season, which is the budget? And oh, by the way, you know, we're approaching November. They come back in February, and their first order of business is the governor will give them budget revisions for the second year of the biennium, and we get to start this debate all over again.
I don't envy your job, Mark.
Well, fortunately, I have Keith Faniff, who is the lead writer on the budget, and we're trying to keep him hydrated and well-nourished.
Mark Pazniokas is here with us from the Connecticut Mirror as we talk about the budget the Connecticut General Assembly finally agreed on nearly 4 months late. After the break, we'll hear from Hartford's mayor about the aid package for the capital city. Will it be enough to avoid bankruptcy? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, we're talking about the $41 billion budget the Connecticut General Assembly passed late last week. In studio with me, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Now, for months, Hartford's Mayor Luke Bronin has been traveling from town to town, stressing that Connecticut needs to help its capital city, a city with fiscal disadvantages like a small tax base, but with one of the highest property tax rates in the state. Now, without significant state aid, Bronin and others had warned that bankruptcy for Hartford might be a possibility. With the budget deal passed last week, did Hartford get what it's been asking for? Joining us now is Mayor Luke Bronin. He's on the phone with us. Mayor Bronin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lucy. Good to be with you. Hey, Paz.
Good morning, Mayor.
So tell us, Mayor Bronin, did you get what you're asking for?
Well, first, I think it's important to talk about what we were asking for, because we were not asking for just a check to be cut or a Band-Aid or a bailout. You know, what we were asking for was the tools that would make it possible to achieve long-term sustainability outside of a Chapter 9 bankruptcy. And I do think that the budget created those tools. The budget set up an accountability board, which we have said that we welcome in the city of Hartford. The budget also gave that board the ability to increase revenue to the city. And importantly, it gave the state the authority to partner with the city as we look to restructure our debt. So it created important tools. There's no check coming to the city of Hartford, in immediate days other than the normal money that flows as part of a state budget. But it creates tools that I think are important. And if used right in partnership between the city and the state, I believe can get us to a sustainable place.
Mayor Bronin, you sound defensive. Is that because this is what you've heard from suburbs on your tour of the state asking for help, that they see it as a Band-Aid, that the wealthier suburbs and taxpayers are helping Hartford out, it's another bailout?
No, not at all defensive. It's because I have believed that one of the things I was most worried about is that what we would do this year is simply buy some more time, that the state would just cut a check and that would buy us another year and a half, but we'd continue to face this same crisis. You know, it's important to talk about the roots of this problem. You mentioned them a little bit, Lucy, but the root of this problem is that you have a capital city that is small to begin where half of the property is non-taxable, and where you have 40% less taxable property than West Hartford, barely more taxable property than small suburbs like Farmington and Glastonbury. That's the root of the problem. Now, on top of that, you have a significant debt burden that grows in the coming years, even though we haven't issued any new debt. And you've got pension obligations and other long-term obligations. But the root of the problem is structural. And I was very wary of a fix that simply gave us some money to buy some time and stave off bankruptcy, but didn't actually solve the long-term problem.
Mark?
Mayor, if you could set aside the debt issues for a moment, when it comes to the day-to-day expenses, how close are you to sustainability? How much help will you need with this new oversight board on that?
Well, look, it depends how you measure sustainability, Mark. You know, if we had a competitive mill rate, a competitive property tax rate, you know, let's say our property taxes were the same as West Hartford's, which is still actually pretty high tax rate, our gap would be so big that you could eliminate every dollar of debt, every dollar of pension obligations, and your entire police force, and you would still have a deficit. That's how big the real structural problem is. Now, we don't have a competitive tax rate. We've got a tax rate that's too high, and that means our gap right now is about $50 million, and it grows as the debt service increases. The solution has got to involve all the stakeholders. It's got to involve the state using the tools that have been given. It's got to involve bondholders participating in the debt restructuring. It's got to involve labor. And, you know, over the next few years, you got to solve a $50 to $80 million problem over the next 5 years, per year.
So the state budget includes an extra $40 million for Hartford. You mentioned some of the other tools, including this oversight board. How deeply will they be involved with something like employee concessions moving forward, Mayor?
I don't know yet. I think the answer to that depends a lot on how willing the remainder of our unions are to come to the table and make significant changes in their contracts. I think there's not necessarily a need for the board to do all that much if our partners are willing to come and be a real part of the solution in a significant way, you know, as our firefighters did last year.
And bankruptcy is off the table now.
But what I would say is, you know, this budget creates tools that make it possible to achieve a sustainable result outside of Chapter 9. And, you know, we have been preparing actively by necessity for the possibility of a bankruptcy filing. Our attention now shifts to using the tools that are in this budget and working in partnership with the state to engage all of our stakeholders to try to achieve that long-term sustainable plan. You know, I think at the end of the day, we should be measuring success on only one thing, which is, are we able to look taxpayers in the eye and residents and businesses alike in the eye and say, we're not just kicking the can. We actually have a long-term plan that's going to create some stability and predictability so we can grow the capital city and create that momentum so that the city can serve as an economic engine for the entire state. That's got to be our goal. The tools are there. But I do want to just say one thing, and Lucy, you said there's $40 million in there for the city of Hartford. There's no direct appropriation. You know, the board has the ability to authorize new revenue to the city, and the OPM and the treasurer's office have the authority to work in partnership with the city to restructure our debt. But there's no check just coming. There's work that needs to be done, and that's how it should be. You know, that's really what we asked for. We asked for the tools and a recognition that you got a structure right now that's built to fail, and that's why it's failing, but we can fix it if we focus on the long term, not just on closing a 1 year or 2 year budget gap.
Do you think there is an understanding of the challenges that Hartford faces? Because certainly at the Capitol and out and around the state, sometimes this becomes reduced to Hartford has screwed up, as opposed to looking at some of the factors that are different, that separate Hartford even from New Haven, Bridgeport. Your poverty numbers are higher. Your home ownership is very low. Has this been absorbed by the broader public at all as you've been going around? Now, there's a softball Mayor. Go ahead.
That might be a question I should ask you, Pat. I mean, you've got your finger on the pulse as good as anybody. I hope that there is a growing understanding, a growing recognition of why we face this problem. You know, again, the root of the problem is you've got a suburb, you got a city that's built on the tax base of a suburb, and that just can't work. And you know, the way my predecessors dealt with that was to try to get from year to year with one-time fixes, whether it was you know, taking reserves or pushing debt payments out, delaying debt payments, or selling off parking garages. You can only do that so many times before you run out of tricks. But the truth is, those things that they did were symptoms of the problem and not the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem is you have a city that's too small, where we have concentrated poverty, and where half of the property in the city is non-taxable. You know, Paz, that the city's had a law on the books for a long time that calls for fully funding a pilot formula, payments in lieu of taxes, to reimburse cities for their non-taxable property. We've got state property that pays no taxes, hospitals that pay no taxes, sewage treatment plants that serve the region that pay no taxes, trash to energy facility that serves half the state and pays no taxes, and then a huge concentration of social service agencies that pay no taxes. When you've got that structure, and the remainder that is taxable is too small to support even a basic bare bones level of service, you've got a structure that is not going to work unless you build a new partnership with the state.
Mayor Brennan.
I hope that people recognize that more and more, but I suspect we're going to have to keep going out and doing our best to talk about it.
Mayor Brennan, I wanted to go back to this fiscal oversight board. I'm just wondering who would be sitting on this board, and then what is the role of the city council moving forward?
Sure. So, you know, the board has a number of appointments. The governor has some appointments. The legislative leaders have some appointments. There are some ex officio appointments. There are multiple tiers. It's important to note this board, it's called the Municipal Accountability Review Board, is not specific to Hartford. In fact, it's a statewide board, and cities or towns go into different tiers depending on their level of fiscal distress. You know, Hartford will be somewhere in one of those upper tiers. The details of what the board looks like and how it uses its authority remain to be seen.
I want to thank Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin for joining us. Thanks for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks, Paz. Take care.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about the budget that was passed by the Connecticut General Assembly. In studio with me, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. When you were at the Capitol, when you were talking to Mayor Bronin just a few minutes ago, Mark, I mean, how do the suburban legislators feel about, again, this help that the legislature is now giving to the capital city?
It's a mixed bag. Connecticut is a state that can be extremely parochial. There are many suburban legislators, including the Speaker of the House and including some of the Republican leaders, who believe that the central cities must be stabilized for a variety of reasons. You know, one is the economy is shifting to a more, you know, millennials and businesses are more interested, it seems, in locating in urban areas. And that's one of the long-term problems that Connecticut faces. Some of its economic growth in the 70s was driven by companies fleeing cities, including New York City, and coming to Fairfield County. So there's that. But yeah, there's a tension there. There's a real tension there. You have people in the suburbs who, again, they look down on Hartford and believe, you know, quote unquote, it's those people. There's a racial component at times. Hartford is a minority, majority city. And so there's a lot packed into that. You know, one of the ironies is, you know, Hartford's pension system has been better managed than most of the suburbs, really than any other community in this state. And part of that was how its charter was set up. Until the recession, Hartford had a pension fund that was 100% plus funded. Now it's dipped down to, I think, the mid-70s, but that's still pretty damn good compared to a lot of suburbs, including the you know, West Hartford, which in this area is considered kind of the gold standard, and they're down to about 50%, you know?
So, I wanted to move on before we run out of time. You know, a lot of attention has been given, and for good reason, that one of the gimmicks in this this budget deal that was passed is a reliance on $175 million coming from energy efficiency funds. I wanted to play a clip from Representative Rob Sampson from Wolcott last week before the vote.
This is money that is collected in your electric bill that goes into a fund that is used for the purpose of helping people find ways to save on their energy costs. But this is not money that is collected on behalf of the state. It's not a tax. It's not our money. It's their money. And for us to go in there and sweep $64 million per year, to me, is the equivalent of theft.
Now, he's talking about specifically the Connecticut Energy Efficiency Fund, but there's other money taken from the Green Bank and the REGI Coalition. Can you break it down for us, Mark?
You know, you think you're listening to, you know, the Wizard of Oz with, you know, lions, tigers, and bears, you know, lapses and sweeps and gimmicks. Oh, my. So a sweep is what it sounds like. It's reaching into one of these segregated funds that has been raised by other methods. And in this case, it's money on your electric bill that was put into a fund where people could, low cost, get their houses fixed energy, you know, to be more efficient. By the way, it's become a decent little industry. It's small but growing. It's, you know, thousands of jobs. And in times of great need, when you're trying to close it, you know, these are the things you do. So, yeah, in each of the two fiscal years, it was 80 plus million. It's not as bad as was originally proposed. This is also an example of one of the dangers of sort of the recklessness that's inherent in budgeting this way. And I don't say that to be as critical as it sounds, because at the end of the day, look, you get behind closed doors, you're trying to cut a deal. But not everything gets tested. Not everything gets examined. And this was a great example. This was also an example of advocates who quickly organized and did, with the help of the governor, shine a spotlight on something that I think a lot of people in Connecticut would say, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And oh, by the way, it's a source of money that really isn't supposed to be used that way. So they were able to convince, they were able to mitigate this, but not completely. There are public policy implications of this. Connecticut and other states have helped grow, you know, sort of green industry, and I'll use that broadly, you know, with a variety of ways. There are tax credits, there are all kinds of incentives. And one of the problems has been this kind of yo-yoing, that one year, we love you, here, do this. And then 2 years later, not so much. So businesses, whether they're small solar businesses, whether they're larger businesses, they crave one thing above all else, and that's stability. So that's another element of this. You're sort of destabilizing a small growing industry.
I wanted to hear from Connecticut's Consumer Council. Ellen Katz is on the phone with us now. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's get your reaction to this raid on energy funds and the impact, Ellen.
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying I don't like it. I think Mark laid out some of the reasons really well. And listen, let me just start by saying these are really difficult times, and I don't want to be a state legislator and trying to decide where you get, you know, where do you get money from when there simply isn't enough to go around. That said, these raids on the various energy efficiency funds, the Clean Energy Fund, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is REGI, and the Green Bank, they total $175 million, and I'm not sure people realize exactly where these come from. These are a line item on your, for the most part, a line item on your utility bill that essentially ratepayers agreed to pay to the tune of about $240 million a year. Okay, so we are paying as part of our electric bill and our energy bill and the natural gas bill $240 million a year. And the idea was, well, why are we doing that? Because we made a deal with ratepayers that we'll invest these monies in energy efficiency. And for every dollar you invest, we'll get, let's say, you know, estimates are about $3 of savings on your electric bill. So it looks like a really good investment. And we've had stability in this fund for a number of years. We've got a growing but really robust green economy, jobs associated with this, and to now sweep the funds. And this means we're not just going to take existing funds, but for the next, you know, year or so, maybe a little bit longer, we're going to be paying money on our electric bill that's supposed to be going into these accounts for funding these clean energy projects. And they'll actually be going, a chunk of it, like of your electric bill funds, about 35% of it will now be going into the general fund. Mm-hmm. And so it just is a tax, okay? So that, if this goes forward as proposed, they're essentially creating a tax on energy bills. And the problem with that is that these kinds of taxes are very regressive. I mean, the folks who are impacted the most are undoubtedly low-income households who pay enormous shares of their total household budget to energy funds, to energy bills. You know, there's estimates of up to 25%. And so this is a real hit to consumers in that sense. And then you talk about what we'd be losing if we take such a big hit. I mean, this is about a 4% overall impact on the funds in general. And actually, I think it's a little bit higher. But when you talk about the impact, there's curtailment of a lot of the programs that are supposed to be invested in. And there's a perception, and I've heard it repeatedly, that, well, this energy efficiency fund just hands out light bulbs, and it's so much more than that. I mean, we invest in insulation and weatherization and other energies, other measures that reduce electric use. And so these cuts would potentially mean 14,000 low-income households will not be served. There will be 14,000 customers who don't receive rebates for investing in efficient air conditioners, heating, equipment. 1,700 businesses won't be served. There's an impact, job losses we predict, of 6,885 over the next 2 years. I mean, these are real people and real citizens who are going to face enormous impacts. And as you, as Mark said, stability is part of what's essential for any business owner, and also for Wall Street. So when we talk about the Green Bank, which are often, the Green Bank projects are also often partnered with energy efficiency. And we make commitments years ahead as a state to funding at certain levels, and this kind of pulls the rug out from under them.
Ellen Katz is Consumer Counsel for Connecticut. Mark, could this be revisited? And if so, where will that money come from if it's not going to come from here?
It'll be revisited in February, in the second year of the biennium. But before that, no. This is baked in. The governor doesn't like it, but as we discussed earlier, even if he vetoes the budget, the votes are certainly there to override.
Well, I want to thank Ellen for joining us. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, municipal elections are next week. Turnout's often low. Why is that? Could part of the reason be residents have trouble finding out any information on local candidates? CTNewsJunkie.com has focused on this issue. We'll hear more after the break. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Do you know what seats are up for election in your town? Municipal elections are next Tuesday. And to tell us more, Doug Hardy joins us now. He's business manager of CT News Junkie and creator of the vote.ctnewsjunkie.com tool. Tell us about that, Doug.
Yeah, we designed it to, we built it to fill a void. There's really not enough information available to voters before the elections for a variety of reasons. We're in the information age now, and people expect to just be able to Google up their candidates and figure out who they are and why they're qualified. And essentially, the news industry is sort of in a recession type of situation, and there's fewer and fewer candidate profiles available. And even when news was booming, I don't know that we did enough candidate profiles as an industry. So a developer friend of ours, Matt Zahaya, we were brainstorming with him about what we could do to help. And solve some problems, and this was the idea we settled on. Essentially, it's a crowdsourcing tool. There's never going to be enough reporters to write a profile or write an article about every single candidate in either a legislative or a municipal election. There were 336 candidates for the legislature last year. That was our first version of this. There are probably closer to 5,000 candidates in, for municipal elections here. So there's also no list. There's no single list anywhere of all these candidates. So what we did is we created a tool that allows us to send an invite to every candidate as long as we have that candidate's information. So we had to do an outreach to get the information from the town committee chairs. And so that was the first step this year. And then we sent the ask for the rest of the candidates, or at least the ones we had in the system. We have about 1,100 in the system.
So you didn't get much of a response from these candidates?
We got about, we're not quite at 10% this year, but we're about 100. And that's decent. Last year, we for a variety of reasons, we only got the thing up and running 2 weeks before the election. So we didn't have a good lead in, but we got about 10% last year. So crowdsourcing is tough. You know, in terms of the amount of response, you're only as good as, you know, as the folks who take part. But what's really neat is that we've got candidates from 61 towns. We've got responses from, you know, from Goshen to Stonington to Willimantic, all the way to Danbury and Fairfield. And there's a variety of people in here. They're all volunteers, first of all. So there's really not any kind of profit motive for any of these folks. And we've got people with multiple degrees, amazing talents. You know, a guy from Goshen is a former road foreman. Woman from Stonington has like 4 advanced degrees. She's running for Board of Ed. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really neat. It's really neat to see these folks answering questions in a sincere way that is absolutely not toxic, like we're seeing at the national in the national political discourse. It's a mm-hmm. pretty neat tool, and we're really enjoying just the amount of response we're getting.
I'd mentioned that turnout's historically low. I mean, what are we expecting to see next week?
And that's a good question. And, you were talking earlier about whether the amount of information available might have an impact on that. And I've been thinking about that. And I don't know about you, but almost every election, every municipal election, I walk in and I look at the ballot and I think, I don't know who most of these people are. Never met them. Haven't even seen a photo.
And so do often people vote on the party line? So
I'm
if
sure
they're registered
they do.
Democrat, let's just go straight across.
I'm sure they do. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they do. And there's some states that don't even do the party line. They don't even list the party affiliation. I think in Oregon they do that. I'm curious about how that's working out for them. But I think party line voting probably, you know, just from a psychological standpoint, party line voting probably has a bigger impact when you don't know anything about your candidates. Mm. We're hoping that this tool will not only, you know, create more engagement for us as a digital news operation, but also help people make better decisions and engage locally.
Doug Hardy's business manager of CTNewsJunkie.com, creator of vote.ctnewsjunkie.com, where you can go and learn some more about municipal candidates if they answered the questionnaires that Doug and his team sent out. Mark Pazniokas is also here in studio, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. You know, no big races next week. What are some of the mayoral races that we should be following?
It's kind of a down cycle this year. Many, not all, of the larger cities have gone to 4-year terms for their mayors. So Luke Bronin in Hartford is not up. Mayor Ganim in Bridgeport is not up. But around the city, around the state, down in Danbury, Mark Boughton is facing opposition for the first time in, I believe, 3 elections. He's still heavily favored. But, you know, one of the issues for him is he's got one eye on statewide office as he tries to win another term as mayor. You have down in Norwalk, there's been some family drama with the mayor of Norwalk, Harry Rilling. He has a son who's a police officer who's had some drug issues, and that popped up not long ago. So this is all, you know, it reminds you that, you know, If all politics are local, local politics are really local. And, you know, you got some you have issues that are unique to communities that drive people to the polls. For example, we saw some dramatic turnover in primaries in Bloomfield. There was a lot of anger over how the town council handled the issue of allowing a Niagara water bottling company to locate there and tap into the MDC. That was a huge issue there, and there were a lot of people who lost in a primary. You know, in Farmington, you had a big fight over a very expensive high school project. So it's hard to look for trends in these things after election night, certainly, depending on if there are any trends as far as Republicans or Democrats. The parties will be quick to claim it means something, even if it doesn't. In New Britain, you have something to look for is there's a young rising star in Erin Stewart. She's a Republican mayor of a city that is Democratic, but yet has elected Republicans as mayors before, including her father. People will be looking to see how she does in that race, to see if she's enhanced or damaged at all as far as a potential statewide candidate. So those are some of the stories you see in local elections. You know, what will the impact be on individuals who may have a future for higher office? Again, are there any trends? Republicans hold control a majority of town halls in Connecticut, although if you look at the population, they tend to be the smaller places. But local elections sometimes do help local parties build an organization that can, you know, help going into the 2018 elections. Not always, but it can help. Will there be any impact from people's anger towards the General Assembly over, you know, the delays in local aid? This the fact that the budget passed will probably take some of the steam out of that. I heard from local candidates who are very concerned that they were going to get blamed for what was happening in Hartford. So those are some of the cross currents that kind of come together on these things.
Doug Hardy, before we head out of the show, what have you been hearing from people who have decided to run in these local towns and cities? You mentioned a little bit earlier, there's not a lot of discord that you see from the national scene, but has that kind of catapulted people into thinking, well, let's try to make the change here locally?
I'll be honest, a lot of the feedback has been I'm having a hard time finding the email. So we've been dealing with a lot of technical issues, but folks have really appreciated the opportunity to talk about their local issues. And of course, it's hard to develop questions, a survey that covers all the local issues.
Well, I mean, this is something that if people get in the habit of doing, you're not getting a great response right now, but if this becomes, if this is there every cycle, It can only grow, and that's great. I mean, the crowdsourcing can help. But, I mean, as I'm sure Doug would acknowledge, there's a limit because these are people answering questions, a little bit of spin. It's not the same as having a reporter out there kind of testing them. But it's certainly another tool that hopefully will grow in use going forward.
That's what we're hoping. The reality is some of these towns, the parties don't even have websites. You know, that's the extreme. Like, there's no website where the parties are even collecting their own candidate profiles, where they're at, providing information and answers to local questions. So the other extreme is there's a local paper that's doing the candidate profiles, and there's a lot more information than there's plenty of information that the candidates are being inundated, But for the most part, these small towns, there's nothing, if you are not engaged, if you're not one of the people, the small number of people that shows up at a public meeting every week, you're not gonna have any idea, So you just sort of lean on the external input, which is, by and large, is pretty partisan, and so you're not maybe, at the local level, I will vote for anybody who I think is competent. The party, it doesn't matter, and that takes a lot of discipline in a situation where you don't really know enough about people. So I really want to know. I want to know. Before I go to the polls, I want to know. And you had mentioned, you guys were talking about trends just a second ago, and election night is brutal. Election night is also a problem. There's not enough information on election night. Our results take forever, and that's another problem that we're trying to deal with. But at the end of the day, we're if we say trend, as the news media, we better have the information.
Well, if you want to get more information on some of the municipal candidates running in your town, head to vote.ctnewsjunkie.com. And I want to thank Doug Hardy again, who helped bring attention to this, business manager of ctnewsjunkie.com. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for having us.
Also, Mark Pazniokas, thanks for breaking down some of the budget. We'll stay tuned to see what happens next from the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live.